Welcome back to the Reading and Writing Podcast. My guest today is Ed Rosick, author of the horror novel Deep Roots. Ed's horror and speculative fiction has been featured in numerous magazines and anthologies, including Pulp House, Creepy Campfire Quarterly, and The Half That You See. Ed, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Jeff. I'm very glad to be here.
Absolutely. Well, if someone listening hasn't yet heard about your novel, Deep Roots, how would you describe your new novel?
Deep Roots is definitely a horror novel set in the urban area of Detroit. Concerns a 30-year-old man, Kevin Siana, who has just been released from prison. When Kevin gets back to Detroit trying to put his life back together, he notices he has this small hair-like thing on his right shoulder, doesn't think anything of it, thinks it's just ingrown hair. And yet he, and then the readers learn over the course of the book that it's actually much, much, much more than ingrown hair.
Well, do you remember the original idea or impetus that led you to write Deep Roots?
I do, actually. The original impetus that led me to write it was probably about 20 years ago. I like the first scene in the book that people can read for free if they want, either on my website or on Amazon. I got out of the shower and I looked at my right shoulder and there was this small, dark, black hair. And I thought, that's kind of interesting. It doesn't look like anything else I've ever had. And it just struck me as strange. Fortunately, my hair didn't grow into what it grew into Kevin, but that really was the start of a story, because I thought, geez, what if it was something nefarious? What if it was something bad? What could that be? And that just grew figuratively and literally into the novel.
Well, what was your initial writing journey that led you to writing and getting your first stories published?
That's a great question. I've been writing forever. I mean, literally since I was probably about 5 years old. I think somewhere in my box of stuff that we all have in our garages or basements, I think there's a book of poetry that I probably wrote when I was really 5 or 6 years old. So I've been writing forever. My writing really didn't take off in a sense of being professionally published until early 1990s. In 1990, I spent 6 weeks at the Clarion Writers Workshop. If your listeners aren't aware of it, Clarion is one of the preeminent writing workshops in the nation. It's a science fiction, speculative fiction writing workshop that used to be held here at Michigan State University. I'm based in East Lansing. And so for 6 wonderful weeks, I was immersed in a writing culture with some of the top names at that time in the literary world in terms of speculative fiction. And it really, really pushed me to the next level. And 2 years later, I sold my first professional story to Pulp House.
That's great. I'm not sure. Are you hearing that kind of like noise in the background?
I am. I don't know what that is.
Huh. Interesting.
I wonder if it's me. It might have been me.
Okay.
I think I figured out what it was. Let's see what happens.
Okay. That's fine. I can just cut out that little bit we're talking about. Can you tell us and talk about your Clarion experience? Because if the listeners aren't aware, as you mentioned, it's a long-running speculative fiction workshop that lasts for multiple weeks. And oftentimes people who go there talk about kind of the rigor that you're not only reading other people's stories, but you're also writing pretty much 24/7 when you're not reading stories or sleeping. So I'm just curious, what was your Clarion experience like?
That what you just said really sums it up. I mean, it's a 6 week workshop that's in the morning. Again, it's been 25, 30 years since I was there, but I would assume it's probably still pretty much the same because it works. So in the morning, everybody sits around. There's generally 10 to 15 people that are accepted into the workshop. We read and critique each other's stories the night before. So in the morning, we would go over those critiques. And then in the afternoon, we would probably spend some time with our instructors where they would either lecture us or do one-on-one critiques. And then later in the afternoon and the evening, we would write. So it's a truly immersive experience. I would I would recommend it to anybody who really wants to take their writing to the next level. In terms of Deep Roots, that even went to the next level in writing workshops. I went to the Taoist Toolbox writing workshop in Taos, New Mexico, with Walter Williams and Nancy Kress, who run that. And they describe it as a master level workshop, and it really is. I mean, people who go to that workshop have either had things published or almost published. And you spend 2 weeks essentially doing the same thing, but even at a faster pace. So that workshop is really what put Deep Edge into publishable territory.
That's great. Well, I know that Clarion, as you mentioned, you have lecturers, and those lecturers are usually successful and published writers. I'm curious, some of the names that taught when you were there, obviously you said it was 25 years ago, but I'm just curious, what were some of the writers that you learned from?
Yeah, so Jim Kelly, who people might know, still an incredible writer, still writing, still working, runs an MFA program out east now, or is a part of an MFA program out east. Michael QB McDowell is out there, or was one of our instructors. Connie Willis was one of our instructors. So you're very correct. It's they're very big name people that are there, and I will assume that it's still that way today. So
sure. And I'm curious, have you stayed in touch with your fellow students?
Well, some of them I have, actually, you know, so for 30 years. In fact, one of the writers is still, I consider him one of my best friends. So it's interesting to see the trajectories we've all taken. I mean, some of us have gone on and kept writing. Some of us have completely stopped writing, which is unfortunate in my opinion, but it's pretty interesting.
And your best friend that you mentioned, is he still writing?
He's still writing.
That's great. Well, what appeals to you about horror as both a reader and a writer?
It's very visceral. It's immediate. It's visceral. People can get into that world, I think, pretty easily. It's just again, something I grew up in, right? I read Creepy and Eerie and Famous Monsters of Filmland as a kid. So that probably influenced me. I don't know. I think it's a very readable genre. And it can elicit a lot of responses from readers. And I think that's a good thing. That's what I want when I read. I don't want to be bored by a book. That's a no-no in my opinion. And hopefully readers won't be bored by Deep Roots. And at least the ones I've talked to that have read it, they've been anything, but they haven't been bored.
That's great. Well, what was your writing process when you were working on Deep Roots? Did you plot the novel beforehand, or did you just dive into the narrative?
Yeah, I don't plot. I wish I could be one of those people that do that. I tried. It doesn't really work for me. I just dive in. I have a general idea where the story wants to go, but I just essentially, as I say, ride the wave, see where the story takes me.
Sure. And I'm curious, is it the same way when you sit down to write a short story? When you write a short story, do you have kind of any idea, or are you just working off of an image or a character? How does that work for you?
Both, actually. I do write off images and just snippets. Very rarely a story will come to me almost written, so to speak, where I know the beginning, middle, and end, and I just have to fill in the words, so to speak. That generally, unfortunately, is not the case. Usually it's a little more work, but I just have ideas. I'm writing a number of short stories with four basic characters that I've just come to know, and so I just go with them. What would they do in this situation? So that's kind of fun, too. That's new for me.
And those are recurring characters that you just mentioned?
They are.
And I follow Dean Wesley Smith, and he does that a lot of times. He has kind of universes that he will start working on a story and decide that it's in one or two or however many, you know, universes of characters. So I think that's kind of interesting to have those recurring characters show up in multiple stories.
Yeah, I don't know, as perhaps as I get older or just as I become a hopefully better writer, my stories, at least many of them, are interconnected. They're in the same universe. So you might see a character from a short story pop up in a novel, or a character from a novel, or a scene or a city from a novel pop up in a short story. So it's interesting how that's working out.
That's great. Well, what writing advice would you offer for listeners who may be working on their own novels or short stories?
A great question. Number one, read a lot. And that may sound funny, but I read more than I write, and read everything. Don't just read your own genre. I read everything from Westerns to serious literature to horror to science fiction. I read everything, really, because you have to know what's out there. And that's how you'll get your own voice. I did an interview a few weeks ago for a newspaper, and they asked me, you know, what you're writing like, who would you compare it to? And my answer was, I mean, certainly it's horror, so you can compare it to the big names like Kuntz or King, but really I like to think my voice is now my voice. You know, if you pick up a story by Ed Rosick, you're going to say, oh yeah, I can tell that it was written by Rosick. And that's what you'll eventually do. You'll eventually get your own voice. But until then, it's okay to say, well, I want to write like Stephen King, or I want to write like Ed Rosick. It's all right when you're starting out like that. But as you move on, you're going to gain your own voice. So read a lot. Number two, write every day. I don't care if it's for 10 minutes. I don't care if it's for a half hour. I don't care if it's one sentence. I don't care if it's one page, but you have to write every single day. And that's hard to do. That's, to me, the hardest part of writing, especially when you're working, right? Especially when you're not Dean Koontz or Stephen King, or mm-hmm. When you don't have the luxury, if you will, of being a full-time writer, that's very, 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 very hard. But you have to do it, because if you don't do it, then if you're not writing, then how do you call yourself a writer? You're not.
Sure. Well, what short stories or novels have you read recently that you enjoy?
Oh man, that's a tough question, because I read so much, Jeff. I mean, I really do. Oh my gosh. I just read Joel Lansdale's latest book. I love Lansdale. I read pretty much everything he writes. What did I read before that? Man, you got me here. I don't know. Well, I can tell you what I just picked up from the library. I just picked up John Steinbeck's Travels with Charlie. I've never read Steinbeck. Never read Steinbeck's Travels with Charlie. I read a lot of Steinbeck. I find it one of the greatest writers around, or used to be around. So I do that, right? I'll read whatever is latest and greatest, and then I'll go back 50 years, 100 years, see what the old great ones were writing. So I just think that's important. So I'm looking forward to Travels with Charlie. I've heard a lot of good things about it.
That's great. Well, what is next for you beyond Deep Roots?
I'm about 40,000 words into my next novel. It's called Wahela. Wahela. Wahela is a mythical, or in this case, not so mythical, beast of the north, a wolf lake, bear lake, horrible creature. It's set in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. I lived in the UP for a few years, so I grew to know it and love it, but it's a very brutal place. It's been described as the Siberia of the Midwest, and it's a very true moniker. So it concerns three people: a 38-year-old female physician, 45-year-old African-American wolf hunter from Alaska, and a 13-year-old Native American teenager who get trapped in a cabin and then have to contend with this horrible creature in the midst of a once-in-a-millennia snowstorm. So I'm enjoying it immensely, writing it, actually, because I'm writing it in different viewpoints. When people hopefully pick up and buy and read Deep Roots, they'll see the point of view is one character's, from Kevin. And that's just the way the story is. And sometimes stories go like that. In this novel, in Wahela, it's through different characters. It's through the three main people I just talked about, as well as through the eyes of the teenage boy's dog, and also through the eyes of the, or the voice, I should say, of the Wahila itself. So it's fun shifting between those characters.
That sounds great. Well, where can people find you online if they'd like to learn more about your stories and your novel, Deep Roots?
They can go to my website at edrosick, that's edrosick.net, and that'll get them up to my website, which I'm pretty proud of. It just went up a few weeks ago. I didn't design it or make it because I don't have that technical ability, but I think it's coming out well. It's, again, it's a brand new website, so there's a lot of things I need to put into it, but it's nice. And they can read the first chapter of the novel of Deep Roots there for free. So if they're at all interested, go on there. Free is one of my favorite words. So jump on in and give it a read. And if you like it, you can either go to Amazon and buy it, or it's now available online at Barnes & Noble. It's at one of our local bookstores here in physical copy, Schuler Books, or you can buy it online there. So it's getting out there.
That's great. Well, again, we've been speaking with Ed Rosick, author of the horror novel Deep Roots. You can go buy a copy of the novel today. And Ed, thanks for doing this interview.
Oh, thank you, Jeff. I appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Thanks.
Deep Roots by Edward R. Rosick. Part 1. He who fights with monsters should look to it that he himself does not become a monster. But when you gaze long into an abyss, the abyss also gazes into you. Friedrich Nietzsche. Chapter 1. Kevin Siano got out of the shower in the cramped confines of his bedroom when the rat crawled on his left foot. Misshapen front claws raked across his toes, and Kevin instinctively jerked away before he looked down to see the creature. Thin, gray fur, with eyes leaking blood, slowly moving forward. Without thinking, Kevin grabbed the creature by its long, scaled tail and smashed it onto the wet linoleum floor. Once. Twice. By the third blow, the rat lay dead, its head a dripping lump of broken bone and brains. Kevin dropped the bloody mess into the waste paper basket and made a mental note to take out the trash before he left for work. "That'll teach me to buy bargain bin rat poison," Kevin thought. He washed his hands before drying off the rest of his 6-foot-tall, sinewy body, moving into his bedroom to get dressed. Next time, it's nothing but the best for those little bastards. Thin blade of early morning sunlight worked their way through uneven metal Venetian blinds that covered the windows of his one-bedroom house on the east side of Detroit. Fatigued, Kevin looked at the clock on the nightstand next to his bed. 6:32 a.m. He shut off the alarm, which was due to go off in 8 minutes. Besides the clock, set a 5x7 faded colored picture in a cheap plastic frame. As Kevin put on a pair of worn but clean jeans, he glanced at the picture for a moment, at the smiling faces of the three people. An older woman dressed in a tie-dyed t-shirt and jeans, in between a lanky young man with long, light brown hair tied in a ponytail, which hung lazily over his bare left shoulder, and a petite, attractive, dark-haired young woman wearing a loose-fitting, simple white dress that stopped midway down her tan thighs. The young man had a tight smile, as if holding something in, while the young woman beamed a joyous grin that could not be faked. Kevin stared at the photo for a few seconds more, then walked back into the bedroom to finish drying his hair. As he started to vigorously rub his head with a towel, a sudden pinprick of pain on his right shoulder caused Kevin to flinch. "What the hell?" He turned his head and expected to see an inflamed zit or an insect bite. After all, he had seen more spiders in the house the last 4 weeks than he had in his entire 30 years of life. However, it was neither a zit nor a spider bite, but rather a raised area of skin the size of a dime on the front of his right shoulder. He cleaned the steam off the bathroom mirror and looked closer. The lesion was a perfect circle, like a tiny bicycle tire implanted beneath his pale, freckled skin. There seemed to be no redness or discharge, Cautiously, Kevin ran his left index finger over the raised flesh. It was hard, devoid of any sensation. No pain, no tingling, a small circle of nothing. Ah, another piece of artwork to go with the rest, he thought. Kevin briefly looked at his forearms, enveloped with a menagerie of prison tattoos and scarifications, concentric circles, jagged pentagrams, crisscrossing triangles, and other geometric designs, then looked away. They were forever a reminder of his time at Fairview State Penitentiary, of his dealings with Charles Riadona, times that he wished with all his heart he could forget. Kevin touched the lesion one more time. Probably an ingrown hair. I guess it beats growing hair out of my ears. By the time he'd finished drying off, the thought of the lesion had completely left his mind. After finishing getting dressed in a white shirt and simple red striped tie, Kevin sucked down a cup of cold coffee and made his way outside. The late September morning was unusually cold, and he considered going back inside to get a jacket, then dismissed the thought for fear of missing his morning bus. Kevin looked up and down the block of Miranda Street for any too late predators. Except for three large raccoons working diligently to get into a garbage bank on the overgrown lawn of a boarded-up abandoned house across the street, there were no other living creatures in sight. He walked toward Lincoln Street, where, four more blocks north, he would pick up a Detroit Metro bus for the six-mile ride to Woodward and Greenlawn and his $10 an hour, cash only, job. He was almost at the corner when he came upon a fresh splatter of blood on the cracked sidewalk. Someone must have gotten popped during a fight. Kevin bent closer to the crimson puddle and flashed back to his prison time. Sitting across from a fat, balding psychiatrist with bulging eyes and an enormous Adam's apple, who'd flash one card after next of Rorschach ink plots. And what of this one, the shrink would say in his condescending voice, staring over his two small glasses at Kevin. I don't know, Kevin replied, knowing he should give some bullshit answer, but he was too tired, too damn defeated to muster up an ounce of energy to lie. And what of this one, the shrink said again, mercifully holding up the last of the cards. The ink blot was different from all the rest. While the others were pale blue in swirling patterns of unrecognizable shapes, this one was dark crimson with sharp edges jutting out from the corner of a small shape that appeared vaguely feminine. Why is that one a different color? Kevin had asked, staring intently at the picture, like looking into the face of a long-lost friend while trying desperately to remember their name. What do you see? The shrink asked, his voice rising in excitement. I want to know why it's a different color, Kevin said with more force. What kind of mind game are you pulling here? Now, Kevin, the shrink had said, his voice back to its usual arrogance. I thought we were learning to control that anger. You know, it's your anger that got you into this unfortunate situation. And it's your anger that... Kevin slapped the card out of the shrink's hand so fast it was like a magic trick. You want to know what anger's really about? Kevin said. His face was mere inches from the shrink's. Try spending 24 hours out in the block and you'll learn more about anger than you could all your years in school. The outburst cost Kevin a month in solitary.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.